Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are going to be going into Madison's notes on the nullification. These are not his notes or report on the Virginia resolutions. What these actually are is an extension much later with a lot of hindsight and a lot of other water under the bridge. And so what we want to do is kind of help you understand this concept of nullification really started growing legs. And people understanding what it meant really went sideways to a point where people today are talking, if Madison and Jefferson were here, because this is exactly what Madison would say, that is an absolute subversion. They're just creating chaos. They're not going to solve the problem. And that's the whole point. As a matter of fact, as long as you're not solving the problem, then most of the players on the battlefield are happy about it. So if nothing that we're doing that the mainstream is really driving, and when I say mainstream, I don't mean mainstream progressives. I mean mainstream conservatives or Republicans and mainstream Democrats, progressives, and so forth. If they're really not solving the problems, then why are we continually getting engaged in their concoctions, their ideas? Oh, well, let's do this. Let's promote a fair tax. Come on, folks. I go through this all the time. If they had a fair tax amendment or a balanced budget amendment, it would destroy the Republic and destroy the essence of the Constitution. You don't believe me? That's a good conversation we can have later on. And as a matter of fact, what I want to start doing is I'm hoping to get into these open discussions with forums or what have you. We're creating a group. If you want to start getting engaged and start calling, we will bring you up to speed, because Reclaiming the Republic is the name of the game. Because when we look at government, when we look at the leaders that, you know, are either leading in politics or grassroots or what have you, no one is interested in actually getting the government into full compliance. Oh, there's too many good little things that are coming out of that that's making everybody rich. And as long as they keep printing money, the opportunity still exists. So, anyway, as you know, it's now or never. We need to get active, educated, and invigorated in getting involved. One of the things I want to kind of take a side note on, because many times people tend to get informed by ill-informed people regarding common law, regarding our sheriff, regarding local government, and so forth. We hear lots of assertions, we the people. We hear lots of assertions of, you know, the sheriff is the chief magistrate for the county. All of this is incorrect. The same thing with common law courts and common people-derived common law courts. And what I mean by that is, if you know somebody that is basically saying, we the people have a right to convene our own common law court, then you must believe that either we live in a monarchy or we live in a democracy. Because in a Republican form of government, we the people can't do that. We have to get our representatives to do that for us. You know, we got some work. We have to start educating our representatives. And so when we look at common law, and we look at common law courts are based on the jurisdiction of the, let's just say, the given county, state, or whatever the field of the grand jury would be, or the court and the jury would be. Because common law actually dictates that practically every case has to go through a jury. Now, I can't think of a time when it wouldn't go through a jury, because even the Constitution guarantees that cases of $20 or more in the Seventh Amendment requires that we have a right as citizens to a common law grant, or I should say, in common law suits to a common law grand jury, or to a grand jury, or actually, forgive me, to a jury. I should just be reading it, but I'm not. So to a jury of our peers. So bottom line, these concepts of having the people judge us from, you know, our own walks of life and from our own vicinage or from our own area, our peers is what they referred to them. And so common law is something that is so ambiguous, it seems like today, that most people just don't get it. The Constitution never declared common law as the law of the land. It didn't. And as a matter of fact, it was brought up in the ratification debate. It said, hey, the Constitution does not declare that common law be the law of the land. And the reason they did that was to ensure that each state at that point in time had their own destiny, their own direction of fulfillment. What kind of law? Did they want civil law or common law? They didn't want to dictate to the people. Now, even though common law by far protects the people the most, it is the superior form of law for the rights of the people, because civil law takes the rights of the whole to be able to oppress the people, where the reverse is in, it holds in common law, that you can't squash the rights of one for the rights of the many. In other words, it goes down and protects the individual, where the individuals in civil law are not protected, because, again, the needs of the many. And so as long as you have a majority of the people that want it or need it, then boom, that's the essence of tyranny by a majority. So when we look at, again, common law at a county level and a county jurisdiction, then can a common law court and a grand jury court deliver an indictment of somebody that's above them, somebody that they don't have the purview over? In other words, they're not a superior court to actually, at a county level, to be able to provide an indictment for your governor. But they can provide a declaration and call for other courts to basically do the same. And this is the beautiful thing about this concept and how a common law court would play out in a state. All you would need is a majority of the counties to declare that your governor has violated his oath of office, violated, you know, the Constitution. And in so doing, you now have the precedence in demanding a state common law grand jury that would actually make up of the different counties, not of the county where the governor is. It wouldn't be, you know, his handpicked friends. It would have to be people that would be selected. And see, that's the whole point. If you understand a common law court and a common law jury, grand jury, is just that, representatives of the people. You don't just go into one given town and say, okay, everybody on this block, you're going to be, because we know you think like us, or this people in this area, because they're all of the same religion. You have to do a sampling of the entire county. So it is representative of the people of the county. So in other words, common law courts and common law systems it dovetails. I mean, it is harmonious with a Republican form of government. And so in a state level, if we actually were trying the governor, I mean, you could have one representative from each county. If each county wanted to be able to be, you know, represent that county, then the people of the county, and it could go to the county commissioners, where the county commissioners could select that, unless the people, and this is why we need to have constitutions where the people can actually dictate, you know, whether it is to be done by an election of the people or a selection of the county commissioners or a selection of the sheriff if necessary. But either way, it has to be, and technically, the preferred way and the constitutional way for a makeup of a common law grand jury would be done by your county commissioners, because they are the sovereigns. They are the legislators for your county. This kind of sets that case where I can't emphasize enough the importance of having a constitutional amendment. But I want you to understand this. there are lots of people out there that are claiming common law courts, and we're doing, you know, they're claiming that these things are happening in common law courts. Everything that has happened that has unconstitutionally occurred, every usurpation of power, none of that happened in a representative court. Because, again, a common law court is a representative court as well as one that is based on established law and established jurisdiction. So how is it, please help me, how is it that when we see these folks out there, such as the sovereign citizens movements and other people claiming that we have to take back common law? No, we have to just restore it. We can't take it back, because talking about taking it back is a democracy concept. It is not within the constitutional framework. The only way we can actually get common law courts going again is by getting your legislator of the county, your county commissioner supervisor, to actually do this and to fund that. This is where they would need to either keep and maintain two courts for the basic jurisdiction of the state court, and then a common law court for the people. Now, if you ask me, I think you should basically scuttle your state court, but again, that's just my opinion. Now, when we come back, what I wanted to do is I wanted to talk about county commissioners in this meeting that we had. We will do that tomorrow, since it's been a week, and I want to give you some insights as to what we're really discussing, why I'm doing this, and so forth. So I want to be able to take more time. We'll be back with Madison's notes. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so one of the things that I need to do, of course, is I need to do the obligatory. As you know, this show is also sponsored by republicreview.org. And this is the only show that gives you the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions for what we need to do, where we need to go, and how we need to do this. And so this is one of the reasons why we read these documents for you. And so hopefully we can actually get you to actually read these, download these, and share these with your friends, because these are very, very revealing. And in this, what we now have is this document that we call Madison's Notes on the Nullification of 1834.
And so I'm going to read the very beginning of this because he explains what's going on and why. So he gives a little bit of history on this concept of this movement, I should say, based on the concept of nullification. See, so many people have just, oh, nullification, that's, we could just ignore it. There we go. You know, that works as kiddie school too, right? I mean, when somebody says something they're going to do, so you just ignore it and it'll go away. Well, that may work a lot in, you know, kindergarten and kiddie school and so forth, but that doesn't really pan out that well in the legal world and in the world founded by law. And so, again, this was written or compiled, because I believe that this didn't just, he didn't just sit down and write this. It was more of a compilation that he completed on in December of 1834, no date given. Although the legislature of Virginia declared at a late session almost unanimously that South Carolina was not supported in her doctrine on nullification by the resolutions of 1798, it appears those resolutions are still appealed as to expressly or constructively favoring the doctrine. In other words, he was going, you know, even though they've come back and said, and this was done in 1828, I'll get to that because that's in the next paragraph, but he's pointing out that they weren't about nullification at all. It was all about interposition, and more importantly, how is that it's grown these legs to where people go, nullify, nullify, nullification, that's the way we got to go. Oh, folks, this is it. It's, you know, it's the Holy Grail. Anyway, so paragraph two, that the doctrine of nullification may be clearly understood, it must be taken as laid down in the report on a special committee of the House of Representatives of South Carolina in 1828. In that document, it asserted that a single state has a constitutional right to arrest the execution of a law of the United States within its limits, that the arrest is to be presumed right and valid and is to remain in force unless three-fourths of the states on a convention shall otherwise decide. Well, it doesn't have to be decided on a convention, by the way. You know, Congress can actually submit an amendment to allow that to happen, and then voila, you just, you know, now you have an amendment that is allowing the law to exist. But what they're saying, though, is that they can just nullify it is absolutely wrong. So Madison goes on and says, the forbidding aspect of a naked creed, according to which a process instituted by a single state is to terminate in the ascendancy of a minority of 7 over a majority of 17, has led its partisans to disguise its deformity under the position that a single state might rightfully resist an unconstitutional tyrannical law of the U.S., keeping out of view the essential distinction between a constitutional right and the natural and universal right of resisting intolerable oppression. But the true question is whether a single state has a constitutional right to annul or suspend the law or the operation of a law of the United States within its limits. The state remains a member of the Union and admitting the Constitution to be in force. With a like policy, the nullifiers, I love how he created this nickname for them, the nullifiers. You know, it's kind of like the deniers, right? That we do this today. With a like policy, the nullifiers pass over the state of things at the date of the proceedings of Virginia and the particular doctrines and arguments to which they are opposed without an attention to which the proceedings in this, as in other cases, may be insecure against a prevented construction, or perverted construction, I'm sorry, a perverted construction. It must be remarked also that the champions of nullification attach themselves exclusively to the third resolution, averting their attention from the seventh resolution, which ought to be coupled with it. Now, when we went through the resolutions, I showed you that the third and the seventh were coupled, because in the third, it talks about the states being duty right to basically,
you know, interpose. And then they talk about taking, you know, working with each other's states in taking the necessary measures. That was in Resolution 7. And so the resolution, which ought to be coupled with it, and the report also, which recommends on both and gives a full view of the object of the legislature on the occasion. This is what's interesting, because I agree with the term, because this truly was an epoch in our governing. Because this is what he says, recurring to the epoch of the proceedings, the beginning of these proceedings, the facts of the case are that Congress had passed certain acts bearing the name of the Alien and Sedition Laws, which Virginia and some of the other states regarded as not only dangerous in their tendency, but unconstitutional in their text. And it's calling for a remedial interposition of the states. It was found also that not only was the constitutionality of the acts vindicated by a predominant party, the Republican Party, but that the principle was asserted at the same time that a sanction to the acts given by the supreme judicial authority of the U.S. was a bar to any interposition whatever on the part of the states, even in the form of a legislative declaration, and that the acts in question were unconstitutional. Under these circumstances, the subject was taken up by Virginia in her resolutions and pursued at the ensuing session of the legislature in a comment explaining and justifying them, her main and immediate objective evidently being being to produce a conviction everywhere that the Constitution has been violated by the obnoxious acts, and to procure a concurrence and cooperation of other states in effectuating a repeal of the acts. She, Virginia, accordingly asserted that and offered her proofs at great length that the acts were unconstitutional. She asserted, moreover, and offered her proofs that the states had a right in such cases to interpose, first in their constituent character, forgive me, to which the government of the U.S. was responsible, and other as specially provided by the Constitution, and further that the states in their capacity of parties to and creators of the Constitution and had ulterior right to interpose, notwithstanding any decision of a constituted authority, which, however, it might be at the last resort under the forms of the Constitution in cases falling within the scope of its function, could not be precluded an interposition of the states as the parties which made the Constitution and as such possessed an authority paramount to it. Now, I know that's all a mouthful, because it's just like there's a lot of meat and very little, you know, carryovers and explanations and so forth. But bottom line, he's basically pointing out that everything that they did in the resolution that we've read and his report clearly delineated what they were supposed to do, that only the states had the authority to step in and to basically throw off the concept. So what he's doing in this particular document, he's only reasserting, but he's actually spending a lot more time in clarifying not just what he asserted was accurate, but why the nullifiers that claim that you can single state nullify, the John Birchers are huge nullifiers, the 10th Amendment Center, they're huge nullifiers. They want you to just nullify laws instead of working together. See, in other words, they want you to be divisive. They want you to actually go out and, you know, not solve the problem and get everybody together, because maybe they're just afraid that if you get everybody into the same room, it'll automatically become a convention. To be clear, folks, for it to become a constitutional convention, it requires that the states petition Congress. If you look at Republic Review, if you look at this process we've built and we've set out, any state, any current state
that has a current application for an Article 5 convention, when they start getting involved in the interposition process and republic review, they are to rescind that petition. They are to formally call out to Congress and say, look, I know we've petitioned you for this Article 5 convention. We are no longer interested in doing that. We are very specifically focused on demanding compliance, and we will get compliance from you. And so with that, you know, we are laying out the groundwork that what we're doing has nothing to do with any problems or amendments to the Constitution. First and foremost, compliance. That's how it has to be laid out, folks. And so when we come back, we'll get back into what Madison is saying on single states. We'll be right back.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so you're going to love what he says in the following. This is why we really need to read this, because he says this in different ways. And because he's so repetitive in saying some of this stuff, it has to go to help reinforce just how wrong nullification is. So those people out there, I'm not trying to insult you, because there's lots of people that have heard and have learned that this is the way to go. Madison will explain to you why that is a perversion and it is a red herring. It will not solve the problem, and actually it extends the problem even further. So paragraph 8 is what he says is: in this view of the subject, there is nothing which excludes a natural right in the states individually more than in any portion of an individual state suffering under palpable or blatant and insupportable wrongs from seeking relief by resistance and revolution. But it follows from no view of the subject that a nullification of a law of the United States can, as is now contended, belong rightfully to a single state as one of the parties to the Constitution. The state cannot ceasing to avow its adherence to the Constitution. A plainer contradiction in terms or a more fatal inlet of anarchy cannot be imagined. Now, let me add to this. See, a state can nullify, but the mechanism of doing that is they nullify everything. In other words, they secede from the Union and they say, we're not going to play here. Folks, if we had states seceding from the Union to where it was only what was left would be the blue states, then the blue states would just tear up the Constitution. They would go hook, line, and sinker with the globalist communist government. They would implement communism, and then we would be dealing with warfare. We would be dealing with the exact strategy I told you what Lincoln should have done for the revolution, or I should say the what they called a civil war. Because bottom line, Lincoln shouldn't have gone after them for the purpose of saying they couldn't leave the Union. He should have waged war against them for their slavery and basically eradicated slavery in the Western Hemisphere. Anyway, paragraph 10. And what is the text in the Proceedings of Virginia, which is spurious doctrine of nullification claims for its parentage? It is found in the third of the resolutions of 98, which is in the following words, quote, in that in case of deliberate and palpable and dangerous exercise of powers not granted by the constitutional compact, the states who are the parties thereto have a right and are duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of evil for maintaining within their respective limits and authorities rights and liberties appertaining to them. So where did that word nullify come up if they're claiming that it's right there? Because the word that was used wasn't to nullify. It was duty bound to interpose. I mean, did you hear me say that? Duty bound to interpose. So when we look further, Madison then goes in paragraph 12 and says, now, is there anything here from which a single state can infer a right to arrest or annul an act of the general government, which it may deem unconstitutional? So far from it, that the obvious and proper inference precludes such a right on the part of a single state. Plural number being used in every application of the term. So when you look up at the quote, he talks about states, compact the states who are parties. There's nowhere where it's singular. He's pointing out that it requires a plurality. It requires technically a majority of the states. A majority of the states must stand and actually demand compliance. And that's exactly what Republicans Review states and does. So in paragraph 13, he goes on and says, in the next place, the course of scope of or a course and scope of the reasoning requires that by the rifle. By the way, when you read these notes, you're going to notice that he uses abbreviations and symbols and so forth. So obviously these are his notes. And I believe he took these notes and transcribed a following response to James Monroe, because most all this stuff went to James Monroe because James Monroe wanted to know so he could help people understand this. Anyway, that by the rightful authority to interpose in the cases and for the purpose referred to was meant not the authority of the states singly, but separately, but their authority as the parties to the Constitution. The authority which in fact made the Constitution, the authority which being paramount to the Constitution, was paramount to the authorities constituted by it, to the judiciary as well as the other authorities. The resolution clearly derives the asserted right of interposition for arresting the progress of usurpations by the federal government from the fact that its powers were limited to the grant made by the states, a grant certainly not made by a single party to the grant, but by the parties to the compact containing in the grant. So in other words, if it took parties to grant them limited powers, it takes parties to get them back into those limited powers, not a single party. The mode of their interposition in extraordinary cases is left by the resolution. It's obvious didn't flow logically in my head. I apologize. The mode of their interposition in extraordinary cases is left by the resolution to the parties themselves. As to the mode of interposition lies with the parties to their constitutions. In the event of usurpations of power not remediable, under the case in the forms by the means provided by the constitutions, if it be asked why a claim by a single party to the constitutional compact to arrest a law deemed by it a breach of the compact was not expressly guarded against, the simple answer is sufficient that a pretension so novel, so anomalous, so anarchical was not and could not be anticipated. Now he goes on, and this is what I love, when he starts going on in these places, and he says, in the third place, the nullifying claim for a single state is palpably irreconcilable with the effect contemplated by the interposition claimed by the resolutions for the parties to the Constitution, namely that of maintaining within the respective limits of the states and authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them. Nothing could be more clear than that these authorities of the states, in other words, the authority and laws of the U.S., must be the same in all, or that this cannot continue to be the case. If there be a right in each to annul or suspend within itself the operation of laws and authority of the whole U.S., there cannot be different laws in different states on subjects within the compact without subverting its fundamental principles and rendering it as abortive in practice as to it be incongruous in theory. A concurrence and cooperation of the states in favor of each would have the effect of preserving the necessary uniformity in all which the Constitution so carefully and specifically provided for in cases where the rule might be in most danger, of being violated. Thus, the citizens of every state are to enjoy reciprocal the privileges of the citizens in every other state. Direct taxes are to be apportioned on all according to a fixed rule. Indirect taxes are to be the same in all the states. The duties on imports are to be uniform. In other words, he's going through this uniformity clause. And one of the things he doesn't mention, because they haven't gotten there yet, but when the states actually start have, you know, disparate disadvantages, such as the Western states, where they have an extra burden because they don't have their land. The federal government has taken and possesses their land and says they can't use this land. What the heck? Are you kidding me? The federal government has no business and no ability to actually create reservations or territories within states. Anyway, going on, indirect taxes are to be the same in all states. The duties on imports are to be uniform. No preference is to be given to the ports of one state over those of another. Can it be believed that with these provisions of the Constitution, illustrating its vital principles fully in view of the legislature of Virginia, that its members could, in the resolution quoted, intend to countenance a right in a single state to distinguish itself from its co-states by avoiding the burdens or restrictions borne by them or indirectly giving the law to them? In other words, just indirectly giving them this ability to not follow the laws. These startling consequences from the nullifying doctrine have driven its partisans, and what we see this today, this is the John Birchers, this is the 10th Amendment Center, even Eagle Forum members are actually going down this path of embracing this corrupt idea of nullification. So anyway, when we come back, we'll be going through more. This is a 13-page document. So we're on page 3 right now. So this will take a little while, but this is so worth it. Now you're understanding why and the details regarding nullification. We'll be right back after these two promos.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so so back to this. And as a matter of fact, one of the things I forgot to tell you is we do have the video uploaded on Reclaiming the Republic. It's not on YouTube yet. I've got to get Kenny B to, you know, take action because he's the one that kind of maintains the Reclaiming the Republic YouTube page. And I, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't even have that information out there for you folks. So we do have it loaded, and it is, well, let me see here. Let me tell you where we have it loaded. I want to say it's the take action page, but I don't think so. Where did we put that thing? So forgive me for having to do this, but important information. Ah, indeed, it is right up top on the take action page for now. We will move that around, and when we do, we'll let you know, but it's right on top. It doesn't go, it shouldn't go there, but most everybody can find the take action page, and there we go. So anyway, back to what Madison has to say, and he goes, this is paragraph 16. Omitting the obvious remark that in such a case, the law would never have been passed or immediately repealed, and the surprise of such a defense of the nullifying right should come from South Carolina in the teeth and at the same time of her own example. The presumption of such forbearance in each of the states or such a pliability in all among 20 or 30 independent sovereignties must be regarded as a mockery by those who reflect for a moment on the human character or consult the lessons of experience, not the experience only of other countries and times, but that among themselves and not only under the former defective confederation, but since the improved system took place of it. Examples of differences preserving differences among the states on the constitutionality of federal acts will readily occur to everyone, and to which error this have defaced and demolished the Union. Had the nullifying claim of South Carolina been indiscriminately exercisable, in some of the states, the carriage tax would have been collected, in others unpaid. In some, the tariffs on imports would be collected,
and others resisted. In some lighthouses would be established and others denounced. In some cases, there might be war with a foreign power. In others, peace and commerce. He's giving these examples here. Finally, the appellate authority of the Supreme Court of the United States would give effect to the federal laws in some states, whilst in others they would be rendered nullities by the state judiciaries. Now, see, here's the problem. You got to get the state courts to even nullify. So why even go there? Because they are of a like mind. The court system has been completely corrupted. Anyway, let's keep going, though. In a word, the nullifying claims, if reduced to practice instead of being a conservative principle of the Constitution, would necessarily, and it may be said obviously, a deadly poison. Thus, from the third resolution itself, whether regarded to be had to the employment of the terms in the plural number, to the argumentative use of it, or to the object, namely, the, quote, maintaining the authorities and rights of each, which must be the same in all as in each, it is manifest that the adequate interposition to which it relates must not be a single, but a concurrent interposition, close quote. If we pass from the third to the seventh resolution, which, though it repeats and reinforces the third, and which is always skipped over by the nullifying commentators, the fallacy of their claim will at once be seen. This resolution is in the following words, quote, that the good people of this commonwealth, or of the commonwealth, having ever felt and continuing to feel the most sincere affection to their brethren of other states, the truest anxiety for establishing and perpetuating the union of all, and the most scrupulous fidelity to that Constitution, which is the pledge of mutual friendship and the instrument of mutual happiness, the General Assembly doth solemnly appeal to the like dispositions in the other states, in confidence that they will concur with this Commonwealth in declaring, as it does hereby declare, that the acts aforesaid are unconstitutional, and that the necessary and proper measures will be taken by for each for cooperating with this state in maintaining unimpaired the authorities, rights, and liberties reserved in the states respectively or to the people. Here it distinctly appears, as in the third resolution, that the course contemplated by the legislature, quote, for maintaining the authorities, rights, and liberties reserved to the states respectively, was not a solitary or separate interposition, but a cooperation in the means necessary and proper for the purpose. Paragraph 21. If a further elucidation of the view of the legislature could be needed, it happens to be found in its recording proceedings in the seventh resolution as originally proposed. The term unconstitutional was followed by a null, void, and etc. These words being considered by some giving pretext for some disorganizing misconstruction were unanimously stricken out, or rather withdrawn from the mover of the resolutions. An attempt has been made by ascribing to the word stricken out a nullifying signification to fix on the reputed draftsman of the resolution. Well, who was that? Who was the draftsman? Well, it was James Madison. The character of a nullifier, could this have been effected, it would have been vindicated, the legislature, and more effectually from the imputation of favoring the doctrine of South Carolina. The unanimous erasure of nullifying expressions was a protest by the House of Delegates in the most emphatic form against it. But let us turn to the report which explained and vindicated the resolutions and observe the light in which it placed the first, the third, and then the seventh. It must be recollected that this document proceeded from representation chosen by the people some months after the resolutions had been laid before them. with a longer period for manifesting their sentiments before the report was adopted and without any evidence of disapprobation in the constituent body. On the contrary, it is known to have been received by the Republican Party. What did he just say there, folks? I gotta highlight this. He just said the Republican Party, not the Democratic Party, not the Democratic Republican Party. He just said it is known and had been received by the Republican Party, a decided majority of the people, with the most entire approbation. The report, therefore, must be regarded as the most authoritative evidence of the meaning attached by the state to the resolutions. This consideration makes it the more extraordinary, and let it be added, the more inexcusable in those who, in their zeal to extract a particular meaning from a particular resolution, not only shut their eyes to another resolution, but to an authentic exposition of both. This is some good stuff right here. And what is the comment of the report of that particular resolution, namely the third? In the first place, it conforms, and the third resolution is what he meant, in the first place, it conforms to the resolution using the terms which expresses the interposing authority of the states, highlighting the states, in the plural number states, not in the singular number state. It is indeed impossible to perceive that the entire concurrence and complexion of the observations explaining and vindicating the resolutions imply necessary, now here it is, that by interposition of the states for arresting the evil of usurpation was meant a concurring authority, not that of a single state, whilst the collective meaning of the term gives consistency and effect to the reasoning and the object. Now, I know that the way he talks and the way he kind of lays things out there, it's probably very difficult for most people to read this. But this is why we kind of have to read this a few times. But this is how you can clearly see. I mean, some of the stuff stands right out. Like, he was clearly saying that interposition had to be done by the states, not by a singular state. That the granting authority of the Constitution was done by the states, not by a single state. So the same, you know, contends that you have to have a multitude of states, a majority of the states, to basically say you can't do this. You don't need a 3/4 majority. You don't have to go down this path. Mark Meckler and all of these people that are calling for conventions of states are absolutely wrong. The John Birchers are absolutely wrong in saying nullification. This is very clear that a single state cannot nullify, and he'll get into this right up here, because he'll actually basically say, up ahead, he's going to say that if a single state nullifies, it must secede from the Union. It can no longer exist in the Union where it does not abide by the laws of the Union. Folks, we're really trying to paint a very clean and clear picture here. This is why we just read the documents, and I do a little editorializing so that you can get your arms wrapped around this. This is really straightforward. We must unite on the Constitution and demand full compliance. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.